Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors. For over 50 years, visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at RackSteel.com. Some text coming in here, and this one from Tony. If Binnington ends up starting against the U.S., how long before he tries to fight a Kachuk? I mean, you got to think that's going to be on the game plan for Team USA, right? Try to get under Binnington's skin, try to throw him off his game, attack his composure. And I mean, in the Kachuk brothers, they have the players to do it, to get in the goalie's face and make life difficult.
Yeah. Without question. The, I mean, that third line, what was it? Brady Kachuk with JT Miller.
Yes.
And who's the third on it?
I'd have to check, but
anyway, it's another rambunctious fellow.
is that what we're calling Keith Kachuk and his two rambunctious sons?
Yeah, well, I mean, the largest adult sons in the game. JT Miller, not on power play one.
Not on power play two, I don't think.
I know.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you a bit?
A little bit.
Do you think he'll be on the PK? Do you think they need someone to point out where the seams are?
I saw the report that it was him and his bud Trocheck on first PK duty. Not how I would be using him.
No. I mean, Miller's a legit weapon on the power play, but I wouldn't have him near the PK.
No.
If I was them. I mean, unless you enjoy watching a guy point around the ice before getting scored on.
Yes. It's
which by the way. That point, the JT Miller PK point was like, you know those ore fish, the doomsday fish that crop up right before earthquakes? It was like the sign that a goal was always about to be scored. So it was helpful from the standpoint of being like, okay, there's a goal about to be scored. I should watch closely.
It was also the ultimate tell about like where the rest of his game was at. You know what I mean? Like when he was playing
totally
really well 5-on-5, he was not pointing on the penalty kill. And it was all like, oh, no, this is not going to be a good Miller night as soon as you saw the pointing start. It's true. But you look at, okay, like first.
100% true.
So first power play unit, the forwards for Team USA. Okay, Matthew Kachuk, Jack Hughes, Austin Matthews, Jack Eichel. That's fine. Elite guys, no problem there. On the second unit, and like all these guys are good players, Brady Kachuk, Jake Guentzel, Kyle Connor, Matt Boldy. Again, all really good offensive players. I think you got to make room for JT Miller on that unit, on the second power play unit, given how, as you said, what a weapon he can be on the power play. Like, it doesn't seem like the best usage of the player to my eyes that he's getting so far from Team USA.
No, I agree with that. And I mean, the thing is this tournament, everyone advances.
Yeah.
Like the stakes are pretty low early on.
It's no, they're not though. It's three round robin games, and then it's just first place, second place
final.
In the final.
Oh, really?
There's no semifinal.
Got it.
So,
if you do lose the first game, if you do lose the first game, you might be in a little bit of trouble.
You're behind the eight ball all of a sudden, especially if Team USA loses to Finland. You know what I mean? Like kind of the consensus weakest team at the tournament. Then all of a sudden you're feeling pretty nervous.
Playing a man short. Like the Finns don't even have a full roster at the moment.
Yeah. All right.
But the Finns always outkick their coverage in these tournaments.
They do.
Like there is such a defined national identity in terms of how to play. And then the other part about Finland to watch for, like for sure, no matter what, the best piece of gambling advice you'll get all tournament is bet them in the third place versus fourth place game.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Finland unders. But
No, Finland, mash Finland. Finland money line, no matter who their opponent is in the third place versus fourth place game, because Finland, in contrast with Russia, Sweden, Canada, and the United States, has like the healthiest worldview about their place in the pecking order of like international hockey.
Yeah.
And they view like just meddling as an accomplishment in a way that I feel like the other the other countries don't. Like, the other countries always never show up. Finland always wipes the floor of them. Finland in the third place game is,
by
like
the way,
the safest bet in international
hockey. I don't even know if there is a third place game in this tournament. I think it's just the final. You're learning a lot about this on the fly.
I am.
All right. Now joining
That's
us.
That's too bad.
Yeah. From The Athletic, he covering goalies for The Athletic, and excited to chat with him today. He is Jesse Granger. Jesse, how's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
We're doing very well. So, you know, lots to get into on the goalie front going into this tournament, and we'll start with some of the news today. John Cooper officially announcing that Jordan Binnington will be Canada's starter, at least for game one. And, you know, based on his comments yesterday, he wants that to be for the duration of the tournament. We'll see how it goes, of course. But what's your reaction to the decision to go with Binnington over Sam Montembeault? But I think Aiden Hill was the other kind of contender for the starting goaltender position.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that they went that direction. That's kind of what I've been expecting from the very beginning, even before the goalies were announced, just because, well, first of all, none of these three Canadian goalies have separated themselves. They're all kind of middling. They're not playing terribly. They're not playing great. They're all kind of playing evenly. And I think that when all things are equal, you look at the Canada team and they've got Armstrong as the GM, who obviously is above Binnington in St. Louis, and Dave Alexander, the St. Louis Blues goalie coach, is the goalie coach for Team Canada in here. So I would imagine that considering all of that, plus the fact that I think Binnington's style maybe suits itself to the chaos of this tournament a little more. Aiden Hill is a big blocking goalie, and when he reads the play well, he's really hard to score on, and he really excels when the play in front of him is predictable. In a tournament like this, where these players are getting to skate together once or twice before they play games, and there might be a lot of chaos, and just considering the offensive talent on the ice, I think maybe a more athletic, instinctual goalie like Binnington may be able to adjust to that type of play a little faster. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that they went with him. I'm interested to see how these teams handle the goalies, because I can imagine that the NHL GMs of these goalies are probably not hoping for their goalie to play four games in a row. I would imagine they're hoping for a rotation. And the fact that Armstrong is the GM of the Blues and he's got Binnington in there, like, I don't know. I'm very interested to see how the goalies go for all four countries and how much we see of the second goalie on each team.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I think especially for Canada, right? Because, sure, John Cooper wants it to be Binnington for all four games, hopefully, if they're in the final game after the round robin. But in a really, really short tournament, you know, one bad game, one bad performance might be enough to get him to shuffle his goalies and maybe try Aiden Hill if things don't go well against Sweden, for example, for Canada. You know, you mentioned the athleticism, that kind of instinctual style of Jordan Binnington. Do you think there's an element here of maybe chasing upside a little bit rather than, you know, more of a steadier performance from Aiden Hill, kind of hoping like, hey, short tournament, let's go with the guy that if he's really on can make some of those five alarm saves for us?
I mean, maybe, but also I look at Aiden Hill and it's like the dude has a 930 save percentage in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I mean, the two times he's played in the NHL playoffs, he obviously went on the amazing run when he took over for Brassois in the second round and won the cup. And he had like a 930 that year and he was in the conversation for Conn Smythe. And then last year he took over midway through the first round series against Dallas and Vegas ended up losing that in seven games, but I think Aiden Hill gave up three total goals in three games. The dude has been spectacular when the games are their biggest. Now, small sample size. I'd argue Binnington's sample size is about the same in the playoffs, though. Like, we've seen him go on one magical run. So I don't know. I would argue that I think that if Aiden Hill, Binnington, and Montembeault all bring their A game, I think I'd rather have Hill's A game over the other two. But we haven't seen his A game lately. He's been playing pretty poorly for the Golden Knights over the last month after a really strong stretch prior to that. So it's just none of the three are in great form right now.
Jesse, how do you rank the goaltending platoons from the three countries? Like, what's your 1-4 going into it and why?
So obviously America's at the top. They're stacked. I mean, America's got goalies. I mean, you guys know Thatcher Demko very well up there. He would probably be starting for most of the other countries, and he's not even an option here. You could throw Joey Decord in there and the two Americans in Toronto that are killing it, Stolarz and Wall. But The three they brought are studs. They can play any of them. Obviously, Connor Hellebuck's the best goalie in the world right now. I would expect him to get all the important games. They're number one, clearly. Where it gets interesting is, to me, Sweden and Finland, because Sweden doesn't have Markstrom and he's out and they're going to go with Ullmark and Gustafsson. I think that they have the deeper goalies, but I think that UC Saros is probably the next goalie I would take after Hellebuck. Like, if you told me you got to have a goalie that wins you this tournament. And I think Finland, you guys were kind of mentioning how they outkick their coverage. They do. They overperform in these tournaments. And another way to overperform in a tournament like this is you just get a great goalie performance. And Saros hasn't been great lately, but playing for Finland, this is kind of separated from how all the struggles of Nashville. I feel like that's going to be refreshing for him. I could see Saros absolutely stealing a game or two in this tournament. So I would put Finland second and Sweden third because Markstrom's not there. If Markstrom was there, I'd have Sweden ahead. And then Canada fourth, just because, like I said, I like the upside of Hill and Bennington, but they're just not in good form right now. So I'd go U.S., Finland, Sweden, Canada.
Not that I expect you to have an answer to our national crisis on goaltending, but do you have any theories for why Canada just kind of stopped producing, you know, Luongo tier guys, given the three generational sort of run that Canada had as the team that would have had the best or one of the best goaltending platoons going into a tournament like this?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've written about this over the last year and a half. I've written about both Canada's struggles and the successes in America and just kind of contrasted those. And I've talked to so many people and like you said, I don't have the answer. If I did, I'd be solving Canada's goaltending right now. But I think that I've heard a lot of theories and a lot of them make a lot of sense. And I think that I was just speaking with Jake Ottinger for a story that'll be on The Athletic tomorrow. We'll plug that one on U.S. goaltending and just the development path that they take. And he mentioned playing for the National Team Development Program, which is just cranking out stars at every position, but goalies in particular. He went through there and he's one of many talented goalies that have gone through there. And he mentioned that, like, I asked him, do you ever talk to your like Canadian counterparts and like just kind of contrast the way you guys, the paths you took to the NHL. And he mentioned that at the development program, they do want to win and they do a bunch of winning, but it's not the focus. He said it was almost like you had 2 years of every day. All you thought about was the technique and how to get better and development and the winning. Every once in a while you have a little international tournament where they want to win and the pressure's on and that's good. But for the most part, you can focus on development. Whereas then you go to college and you've learned all these things and now you go to college and you still have some more time to season. Whereas he said that maybe the Canadian goalies that go to the CHL, there's so much more pressure on everyone at that level because the coaches are coaching for their jobs. If you aren't winning, you're going to get fired. Like if you struggle as a goalie, you can lose your net and end up not playing very often at 16 years old. And who knows if that goalie would have ended up being better if he had just had more time to work on his game and a little more patience. But you don't blame the CHL coaches for not having patience. I mean, they're in the business of winning. Whereas I think that the development path for American goalies is a little slower, a little more patient. You look at some goalies like Connor Hellebuck, never played for the national team. He wasn't in World Juniors. He wasn't, because when he was 14, he wasn't the best goalie in the world. It took him some time. Ben Bishop, that's a later example or an earlier example, but that's another guy who it took him some time to fill into his body. If we were picking who the best goalie is at 14, 15 years old, he wouldn't have been anywhere near that. And then he ends up being a stud at the NHL level. So I do think that there are small things like that. I think there are also, the private goalie coaching business is such a big business now, and it wasn't that long ago. And I think that you see a lot of young goalies that are getting pulled in different directions. They go to a camp, they learn all these things, then they go to their team, they learn a different way to play goalie, and they're just thinking too much, and they're not playing instinctually, they're not reading the play, they're thinking too much about, well, is my elbow tight enough, my ribs, instead of, is this player in a position to pass? Is there a passing threat on the backside? I think that they just get a little too internal with their thoughts and too technical. So I've given you a million reasons, and I don't know which of them are the main reason, but I think that they all kind of factor in.
Yeah, the contrasting development paths is really interesting, but one of the most baffling things about it is it's not just a Canada versus U.S. issue, right? I mean, like, Russia's not at this tournament, but if they were, you'd like their goaltending more than Canada as well, right? And then Canada would be in fifth place. So it's it's not that just that they're falling behind the U.S., it's that they've also fallen behind, you know, Russia, the U.S., Sweden, Finland, all kind of simultaneously all have really good high-end goalies that Canada, for whatever reason, is just missing. And to me, that makes it kind of even more difficult to identify exactly what the issue is, because the development path in all those countries is different, but for some reason, they're all able to churn out high-end goalies.
For sure. And I wrote a story on the Russian goalies last year where I spoke with Vasilevsky, Bobrovsky, Shesterkin, and Sorokin and just tried to find similarities. And I will say that I think, similar to what I was saying, it's not as technical. It's like goaltending, the technicalization of goaltending has been great. And it's why you can't score on a goalie when he sees the shot nowadays. Like the goalies, yes, the save percentage has gone down because the shooters and offense is getting better, but goalies have never been better than they are right now as a whole. And that's largely because of the technical aspects and the way goalies think about the angles. But I also think there is some benefit to being instinctual, especially at younger ages, and just letting goalies play and not thinking about what position every little thing is in. And I do think that if there's one thing Canada's doing more than Russia and the U.S., it's getting very technical with goalies very young.
You talked about Jordan Binnington and Aiden Hill, neither of them at their best recently. And in such a short tournament, you know, form, current form could be a huge factor in not just goaltending, but really for the whole tournament. But sticking with the goalies specifically, are there any other goalies that you see either with maybe some red flags in their current form at this tournament, or maybe that might really outperform what we tend to think of them based on how they're currently playing in the NHL?
Yeah, I mentioned Saros late, and he's been very bad lately. I think early in the year, and like obviously that's partially a product of how bad the Predators have been, but early in the season, even when the Predators were losing games, Saros was excellent. And I thought he was actually keeping them in games. And I remember saying at the time, wow, this team that was expected to win is losing all these games. Usually it's the goaltending. They're getting great goaltending, and they're still losing all these games. This does not bode well for them turning it around. And the team has turned it around a bit. They're scoring more goals, but then when that happened, Saros' game fell off a little. So it's part of the reason they haven't been able to climb out of that hole. And I think, like, you look at Saros, since January 1st, he's got negative 6.6 goals saved above expected, which is worse. That's the worst of the 12 goalies in this tournament. And Kevin Lankinen has been much better than that. He's still, I mean, even Lankinen is his game isn't as good as it was early in the year, but he's above goals saved above expected. He's above average in that. So I don't know if the Finns will turn to Lankinen at any point, but it wouldn't surprise me if Saros struggles early and they just say he just doesn't have it right now. We've got a great goalie in Kevin Lankinen who's playing better this season. He's probably having the best season of his career. Let's give him a chance. I wouldn't be surprised if Lankinen gets in there and plays well.
What do you make of, to switch gears a bit and just get your take on the Vancouver Canucks? You obviously follow Vegas closely, and Vancouver has been an interesting story in goal this season, so I'm sure they've warranted your sort of thought and attention over the course of the season, Jesse. Just as Thatcher Demko was getting his game in order, he leaves the game hurt again. He hasn't finished two of the 17 games he's started since returning from the popliteus tear in December. And Lankinen has kind of carried this team for large stretches of this season. What do you make of sort of where Vancouver's at in net, especially given that Lankinen's a pending UFA and that Demko becomes extension eligible on July 1?
Yeah, it's like everything with this team, it's an interesting situation. there's a lot to unpack there. You guys never have a lack of situations to break down up there. But I will say that the Demko injury is very concerning. Like I hate the term, like, I don't like to generalize players as injury prone. I just don't like it because I think, I mean, you see it in every sport. There are guys that are never hurt, and then all of a sudden they go through 2 year stretch where they're hurt all the time. There are guys that have been hurt for 5 years, and then they go on an Ironman streak and don't get hurt for a long time. So I think that in general, I don't like that phrase. But the fact that Demko, there was questions of whether he would be able to come back at full strength from this injury. Like, this isn't a typical injury that I remember people wondering if he'll ever look like the same goalie he was. He comes back, he immediately has been hurt twice more since then. I think that there's some legitimate concern there. But at the same time, as good as Lankinen's been and as hurt as Demko's been, I would be very hesitant to not think of Demko as my goalie of the future moving forward, because he's just so good. It's such a difficult situation. I do not envy the front office having to make this decision, because when Demko is healthy, he's as good technically as there is in the world. He is just amazing. His footwork is so good. He's a giant guy, so he takes up a ton of the net. I would still lean towards putting my eggs in the basket of Demko, just because I think that as good as Lankinen's been, I think you can find that. I think you can go get, if Lankinen gets paid by someone as a starter and leaves, I think it's easier to replace that level of goaltending that you've been getting from him than it is to replace, you're not going to find another Thatcher Demko. It's going to be very difficult to find a goalie that can reach that level, that type of difference maker when he's healthy. So I guess as good as Lankinen's been, and I really like watching him play, I just don't think that he will ever be the type of goalie, difference-making goalie, that Demko can be when he's healthy.
Staying on the Pacific Division here, what's your take of how this is going to shake out? Your tiers. Let's do that. I love doing Pacific Division tiers. We haven't had the occasion to do it enough over the course of this season. How would you tier the teams in the Pacific Division at the moment?
I think that Edmonton's the clear. I think I would put Edmonton in a tier of their own. I think they're the best team in the division. They went through some struggles early in the year. Skinner, pucks weren't hitting him. He's looked a lot better lately. I think Edmonton's the team to beat. And then I would put Vegas and LA in a tier together by themselves. I think they're probably going to end up playing each other. That's going to be a very tight checking series. It's going to be hard to score. Every game in that series is going to be 2-1 or 1-0. And then I think Vancouver and Calgary are the next tier. And then the other three are pretty terrible. But I think that this division has five good teams that could, any of these teams could beat the other teams. But I think Edmonton's the clear favorite. I think Vegas and LA are proven, structured, big, strong teams that are built for playoff hockey. And then I think Vancouver and Calgary are both interesting teams with talent. I love what Dustin Wolf's doing in Calgary. He's been brilliant, and I think that he's exceeding any expectations, and the expectations were already pretty high for him. He's been great, but I don't know if that team overall has what it takes to hang with maybe the top teams. And Vancouver it's tough to figure out what this team is because of all the big moves, and we don't know if Pettersson's going to be around or improve from what he's played. I don't know. I have a very hard time reading what the Canucks are going to end up being, but I would put them in that tier with Calgary, right below Vegas and LA.
Yeah, you have a hard time reading the Canucks. So do we all up here. It's been a very, very interesting experience trying to get a read on this team this year. Jesse, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us today. Enjoy the Four Nations tournament.
Will do. Go America.
That is Jesse Granger from The Athletic weighing in on the goaltending situation for various teams at the tournament, and also talking a little about the Pacific Division and how he sees it breaking down and putting Calgary right there in a tier with the Canucks. And certainly, you look at the standings and that's where they are. But obviously, as a goalie guy, he's very high on what Dustin Wolf has done and can do for the Calgary Flames in the crease.
Yeah, I mean, Dustin Wolf's sick. And, he's not the biggest guy, but he also doesn't play like a smaller goalie. He just plays straight up good technical goaltending, and he just makes it work. And I think that's phenomenal, because in a lot of ways it almost makes him harder to exploit the way that teams, have figured out how to work your average 6 foot tall goaltender, up high. It takes a pretty special athlete, frankly, to do the Saros and Marc-Andre Fleury thing and have success durably. But Wolf's done it in the American League level, and he's sort of just picked up right where he left off. I still don't think Calgary has the juice to keep up, right? It's been a long time where I've just been saying, hey, either Utah figures it out or Vancouver's making the playoffs, and I still believe that for the most part. But Wolf's given them a shot. He's allowed them to hang around longer than I would have expected. In addition to, look, they've played really clever structural hockey all season, and they've been a max effort team with a level of consistency that, you know, certainly I admire, given what I've seen for much of the season from the team I cover regularly, right? Like, I'm serious. If Vancouver had worked as hard this season, and look, there's a variety of reasons. I'm not even blaming anybody. It's just that, you know, the gap, if you're watching the Flames regularly and the Canucks regularly in terms of like that focus and energy, it has been massive. There's a 3-point gap between them. There should be a 13-point gap between them based on the talent level that these rosters came into the season with. And, you know, I honestly think that would be the case if Vancouver had worked the way that they have did last season consistently, or the way that Calgary has this season consistently.
Yeah, that's been one of the huge factors for the Canucks, and one of the big questions now with, you think, some of that drama or all of that drama in the rearview mirror, can they find that consistent level of engagement and effort when their season resumes in a couple of weeks here? We'll take a break. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We have an open segment to finish up the show at 1:30. So any questions about the Four Nations, about the Canucks, going into the trade deadline, all of that, you can send them in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. But as mentioned, up next, former Canucks defenseman and Team Canada defenseman, Olympic gold medalist at the 2002 Olympic Games with Team Canada, Ed Jovanovski joins us on the other side here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. New Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. Now joining us here on the show, very excited to welcome former Canucks defenseman and, of course, a member of Team Canada at the 2002 Salt Lake Games, Olympic gold medalist. He is Ed Jovanovski. Ed, thanks very much for joining us today. How are you? Ed, we have you there?
Yep.
All right, there we go. How are you, Ed? Thanks for joining us.
Oh, I take you off the old Bluetooth. I'm in my car. I'm doing well, man. All good. All good. Looking forward to the start of this Four Nations tomorrow. Should be fun.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to start. I mean, as a veteran yourself, as you know, one of the guys who got to have that experience, who earned that experience to represent Team Canada on the international stage, how excited are you to see this event for the first time this week?
Well, I'm really excited. I think when you look around the league, it's been a kind of a, it's been a pretty grueling schedule for the league and for guys that are going to the Four Nations, just hearing all their comments, how super excited they are. And the other guys just kind of welcome kind of rest time just to get ready for the last handful of games as we approach the playoffs. But certainly excited. It's been a while since we've seen, you know, a little international flavor with the best on best. And I tell you what, looking at these lineups, and all these power play units that are coming out right now, it's gonna be real fun to watch.
Yeah, some of the combinations that the coaches can put out there are pretty outrageous. And you know, I want to go back to your experience with Team Canada at the Olympics, Ed. And you know, just first of all, I mean, when you were selected to Team Canada, what was your reaction? What did that feel like when you got the call and knew, okay, I'm going to be a part of this team?
Well, I was on the highway. I lived in West Van when I was in Vancouver. So I'm getting onto the highway and I get a call. Steve Tambellini actually was working with the team at the time. He called me and let me know that I was named to the team. And, you know, the rest of the drive to the rink, I was just trying to keep her on the road. You know, I was just obviously really excited. And, you know, when you look at that team, I believe I was 23 or 24 at the time. I think for me, walking into that locker room with those guys was surreal. I mean, it was amazing. you know, the company that, you know, was around and just watching these guys prepare and everything. But the whole experience was special because you never know when these opportunities come, right? As a select few that are fortunate enough to represent their country on that stage, and to be one of those guys is something I'll never forget and always cherish.
Ed, great to have you on. You know, for this generation of players, right? Because you just talked about how much it meant to you. I mean, you still remember the drive when you found out, which I think is enormously telling about just how significant the honor was from your perspective. What do you think it means to this generation of guys to just have an opportunity? Hey, it's not the Olympics, but just have the opportunity to represent their country in best-on-best competition like this. What do you think it's going to mean, and how do you think it'll impact the atmosphere of some of these games we're going to get to watch here?
Well, I think the atmosphere, for the second part, I think the atmosphere is going to be great. It's two great host cities, obviously. You know, the buzz, you know, around, it's going to be electric in these buildings, so I don't think that's anything to be worried about. I heard some comments, you know, how hard are they going to push? They're going to push. You know, they want to win. I think anytime you put that sweater over your head, you're representing your country and you take pride in playing for your country, because we all know a lot of these teams can put a couple teams together. So to be that select group to be representing your country in this event is telling what kind of player and character you are. And what they remember, I mean, I think it's just the magnitude of it. I think when you look at the players that are gone and the best on best, it's an opportunity that you know, they'll never forget. And it'll be a lot different. I mean, kind of predicting, you know, just thinking about the opportunity of winning, right? You know, how, you know, that, you know, euphoric moment will be for these guys. And it's just one of those things. I think any time that you get the call for your country, it's big. And I think that it's just kind of the only way you can kind of really slice it. I think it's when you look at representing your country at an event like this, and the magnitude, the hype around it, it's special. It's a special moment, and certainly something that you'll never forget as a player. Because I know covering Matthew Tkachuk over here, I mean, the questions the last few weeks are always coming up about this and about playing with his brother, and just the glow in his eyes about the opportunity to do this. I mean, you can tell how excited he is, and then as you can hear the other interviews around the league with guys that are representing their countries, they're all in that same boat. So it's a big one. The magnitude is really great, and I'm sure these guys are really pumped up to get going.
So you're from Windsor. You spent a lot of your career playing in Vancouver. You represented Team Canada, but now you're a Florida Panthers broadcaster. Are you, like, contractually required here, Ed, to root for Team Finland?
Right. And representation is crazy with the amount of guys for the Panthers gone. You know, I know everyone, you know, here in Florida is excited for the guys that get that opportunity. But, you know, you look at, you know, and Coach Maurice said it good. You know, he knows what he's going to get out of Matthew and Rhino, you know, when they're there, and Barkov in Finland. But the excitement, how what he's going to is watching Lundell and Lucerainen and Mikkola, you know, play against shutdown roles against these guys. So that's kind of the little, you know, what the things that you're going to be looking for, you know, as a coach, you know, he said. But it's great representation of the Florida Panthers in this tournament, and makes excited for all of them.
It's pretty wild when you look at just the sheer number of guys who are there from Florida. I mean, I guess no surprise in some ways, right? They're the Stanley Cup champions for a reason. But, you know, even on Team Canada, Sam Reinhart and Sam Bennett both there. But you mentioned the power play units for some of these teams, and Reinhart, the guy who gets to play with Crosby, McDavid, MacKinnon, Makar on that first power play unit, 57 goals, pretty nice spot for him to be in. And, you know, how have you seen his game develop since he arrived with the Florida Panthers organization?
Well, it's been great. I mean, he's such a good kid, and he's always willing to, you know, to get better. You know, you see him you know, with the 57 goals last year, and you can see how closely, you know, he's being checked in certain situations, for example, on the power play. But he's so elusive and smart that he'll find somewhere to get into that open hole. And, you know, his work ethic is there. Not only is, you know, he's a goal scorer, but you can see he plays both ends of the ice. He takes pride in that. So it's great to see. And he's such a humble kid that everything that he's getting, he deserves. He's worked for it. And it's just great to see him, you know, getting the opportunity at least to start, you know, with those guys on the power play. That's some power play.
Yeah, should be pretty good. A fair bit of talent that they can, that John Cooper can put out there on the power play. You know, you mentioned in the on the 2002 team just what it meant for you to step into a locker room with, you know, you look at the guys like Merrill Lemieux and Yzerman, and even on the back end, Al MacInnis, like so many incredibly accomplished Hall of Fame caliber players who were a little bit later on in their career, but they'd won cups, they'd done so much, and, you know, probably Sidney Crosby playing that role on this team this year for Team Canada. But I mean, what was it like for you at that stage of your career to just get a chance to be around players of that stature, leaders like that for that tournament?
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. I think it was just a special moment, and they were all so warming, and no one was, you know, bigger than the team. Everyone, you know, respected each other, and us being the young guys, you know, just the time that Stevie Y took to hang out with us and make sure that kind of we're with the group, and walking in and watching Mero do crossword puzzles, you know, it's just like just the little things that you kind of remember how their preparation was, just how, you know, what, you know, Paul Kariya was doing before the game, quiet. You can see him as in the zone. It was great to see at a young age, you know, to pick those things up from these guys. And that kind of brings me to the next point where, you know, you have eight guys that are representing the Panthers going to this. You know, the question always kind of arises, you know, how is it going to look when they get back? Well, I know when I got back, my confidence level was super high. I was excited to play, and I felt my game only accelerated, you know, after the Olympics. So being the stretch drive, I think getting all these players back that performed at this high competition, you know, something that they pick up while here playing with the other best on best would really help the group down the stretch. So kind of a win-win. I know you kind of worry about possible injuries and whatever, but you can't really think like that. I think it's an opportunity you can't pass up as players.
Ed, just from a Panthers perspective, I'm curious to get your take on this because you brought up the break a couple times. We've talked about how many, you know, whether it's Barkov, Lundell, Listerainen, Tkachuk, on and on, Reinhardt representing their countries at the Four Nations, Forsling too. Basically, the entire Panthers core is playing at this tournament, but the rest of the guys do have 2 weeks off, and you're talking about a team that's played 55 additional playoff games over the last 3 years and is going for, you know, a shot to make it to the Stanley Cup final for a third consecutive year. And let's be real, they look like one of the best teams in the East again, certainly in the top three. How does this sort of break, what's the impact of this break, whether it's the guys who aren't competing at the tournament having a chance to get rested, whether it's the fact that most of their core doesn't get that opportunity, does it have any impact in your mind for what the stretch run and sort of going into the playoffs is going to look like for this Panthers team?
Yeah, I think it's a win-win, guys. I think when you look at the guys that aren't playing, take, for example, Ekblad. You know, he's kind of been banged up. He's been healthy now, you know, but he has a 24 to 26 minutes each and every night against the league's best. He's played a lot of hockey the last handful of years. A guy like that really benefits, you know, taking the rest and really kind of getting your mind right. You know, now you're so pumped up, you're excited. You got, just say, 25 games left or whatever it is. You know, you're jacked up, ready to play. And you have the guys that come back, you know, continue to play. And, you know, they've gone through this tournament, and now their game, they've got to be feeling really good about their game, you know, coming in the stretch drive. So I think getting the guys to rest, you know, is really important. And then these guys that are coming back, I'm sure there's going to be some sort of management as far as practice, how they're going to, you know, maybe take some days off here and there to make sure they're fresh for the stretch drive. But it's I think it's something that's really gonna, you know, benefit in, on both sides of it. I don't see there any really negative or downplay on these guys going to play or in the guys resting.
And Ed, you know, just you experienced the Vancouver hockey market. You were part of some high profile teams here during that West Coast Express era, and you know, this Canucks season, I'm sure you've seen it from afar or been following it at least a little bit from afar in terms of, you know, locker room discord and all the drama and discussion that's sort of come out of this market. How difficult can it be to handle those locker room dynamics as a player? And did you have any sort of takeaways from sort of what the talking points have been around the league about this team over the course of the season as a guy with experience playing here?
Right. Well, it's such a fine line because, I mean, we're hearing things. I never dug deep into kind of what's the real story. I just know when you have a couple guys that aren't willing to kind of put the BS aside, sort of say, and put the team first and go from there, I think there's always going to be some sort of dissension in that area. And you hear the top, and it's so true, you don't have to be best friends. Even though I got along with all my teammates and had good relationships with all of them, you know, you don't have to be a best friend with someone to have, you know, a successful group. There's always going to be, you know, a couple guys that don't see eye to eye, and but you have a common goal in front of you is to win hockey games and ultimately win, you know, the Stanley Cup. And I think this whole situation has been really unfortunate. I felt bad for Tuch in this situation because I'm sure he's the ultimate team guy when he played. So I know probably he exhausted every effort to make sure that things were right. But ultimately, at the end, you know, a guy was traded and you know, the team made a move to best on the team moving forward. And here we are today. You know, the guy's a really good player left Vancouver. And it's just a tough situation when you kind of hear these things. But, you know, life goes on and you got to make best with what you have.
Just a couple more minutes here with Ed Jovanovski, former Canucks defenseman and Olympic gold medalist with Team Canada in 2002. And just to touch on those 2002 games again, Ed, before we let you go here, you know, one similarity between that year's team and this year's Team Canada, beginning their tournament with a game against Sweden. Of course, in your case, it was a loss and there was a lot of panic and a goaltending change. I mean, I was in high school at the time, but I remember it well. There were, of course, coming off the 1998 loss where they didn't medal. There was a lot of angst up here. Let me tell you about that. What do you remember just kind of from that point on in the process of growing together as a team and rounding into form and eventually, you know, being at your best in the gold medal game against the U.S.?
Yeah, I remember Gretz almost addressing the country at that moment saying, hey, listen, it's one game. Still got, you know, time left here. We'll be okay. I actually myself in Ryan Smith or where we actually didn't play that game or Eric Brewer, whoever it was, we're out of the lineup in that game and watching it, you know, from the stands. And it was tough because, you know, you're looking at this game and you think that, you know, all the hype around Canada and then things don't go your way. But you know, you make adjustments and you move forward, and that's exactly, you know, what the team did. And when you look at these tournaments, there's not much time. You had, obviously we had to kind of get together in the off season, kind of went through some things on systems, how the team will play, but that was game one, right? So you make adjustments and now you move forward and everything clicked, you know, after that. And, but that's the issue with the short tournaments, right? There's really, that's what makes it so special is there's not much time, you know. You don't have that room where you have 15 games to kind of, or 20 or a full hockey season to get yourself out of something. These games are so imperative. You want to rack up the points and you want to be at the top. So, you know, that's where, you know, the angst really comes in for these countries is that you got to be ready to get going right from the drop of the first puck.
Ed, this was awesome, man. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. Fun to look back on those memories, and hopefully we get a great tournament this week and next.
All right, guys, anytime. Good luck down the stretch up there.
Hey, we appreciate it. Thanks, Ed.
All right, guys. Take care.
That is Ed Jovanovski, former Canuck and, as mentioned, Team Canada defenseman in 2002 in Salt Lake. And, yeah, he referenced the famous Gretzky press conference, which I think came because it wasn't just the Sweden game, remember, in 2002, right? They lose against Sweden, barely beat an undermanned or an overmatched Germany team, and then I think tie the Czech Republic. And it was after the tie against the Czechs that Gretzky came out and really had a lot to say about what the conversation was around Team Canada. But, you know, it's easy to kind of forget they win gold in 2002. Okay, 2006 is bad, but win in 2010, win in 2014. There's a World Cup in 2004 mixed in there. There's a lot of World Junior success mixed in there, right? Going into that 2002 Olympics, I think there was a lot of concern about where exactly Canada stood and kind of the world hockey hierarchy and the pecking order. And it was coming to a head before they ended up rallying to win that gold medal.
Yeah. I mean, it had been a long time too, since Canada had won. First of all, it had been a long time since that we'd seen real best on best. Right. But also, you know, the overall, Canada hadn't won in 92, right? Canada hadn't won in 96, obviously, in Nagano. It had been a long time since Canada mm-hmm. won a gold medal in men's hockey. And, yeah, I mean, and even after they won that, you know, they lose in 2006, a 2-1 loss. A really oddly assembled team when you look back on yep. sort of that Turin roster. And that all served to amp up the stakes for 2010, right? Like it's quaint to remember how uncertain we were that Canada was going to win that tournament, especially after they lost pretty convincingly to the States early on in the sort of round robin round in Vancouver. One thing that always sticks out to me, Jamie, when I think about 2002. Sweden comes out and just pumps the Team Canada
yep.
in the opening game of that tournament and ransacks the preliminary round playing. Do you remember they were playing that torpedo
yes,
formation?
Yes, I do. And the discussion was very much Sweden's the future and Canada's been left in the dustbin. That is ancient, correct. Archaic hockey, and Sweden is pointing the way forward and we're not going to be able to keep up.
So, and the torpedo system in hockey, right? Consists of four forwards and one lone defenseman. By the way, it's two torpedoes up front, two halfbacks, and one lone defenseman or libero.
The sweeper.
The sweeper, that's right, is technically how it plays. And it's an up-tempo system leaning on forechecking, right? Which is why they have torpedoes, with sort of a stretcher torpedo pass being sort of the fulcrum of how you'd attack. And obviously Team Sweden had Nick Lidström, pulling the strings on the back end, which made it pretty imposing. And then, of course, Team Sweden gets hideously goalied against Belarus.
Upset
right?
and of the century against Belarus.
Upset of the century, and the goal goes in from the red line.
Yep.
Tommy Salo, gets hit in the head by a shot from the red line by a Belarusian defender, bounces into the net off of him, one of the craziest bounces in hockey history, and no one's ever seen the torpedo again. We've never seen it. I still reflect on this as one of the great what ifs in the history of hockey tactics. Are we sure it doesn't work? No one's really tried it. You know, it was Hardy Nilsson used it for Jew Gardens. The Swedish national team used it. And then it got completely abandoned because a puck bounced in off a goalie's head from the red line. Are we sure this doesn't work? Are we sure someone shouldn't be trying this still?
It is wild, too, because we all I think the narrative of that tournament now from the Canadian perspective is, you know, what I laid out, struggling in the first three games, Gretzky gives that talk, and then they rally, and it's this incredible rally, and they ultimately win gold. And obviously, you know, that's true to an extent, but we do tend to forget about avoiding Sweden in the semifinals. They got to play Belarus in the semifinals, and it was a cakewalk. I still remember watching that game in the gym at high school. I was like, this is amazing. This is the best, because Sweden had that incredible upset against Belarus. But even, you know, I was looking back today, like in the quarterfinals, they beat Finland 2-1. You know, it wasn't like as if like, okay, we've found a new gear here and now we're going to stomp all over Finland. Then they get Belarus in the semifinals and they ended up playing a fantastic game against the U.S. in the gold medal game. But it's kind of, I think, the forgotten part of that tournament is like there was a lot of concern about what would happen if they Sweden. If they played Sweden again in the semifinals, there would be no fingernails left in the country of Canada, right? They would all be chewed away. There would have been so much stress about that matchup given what happened in the first one.
So one last sporting memory that I have absolutely seared into my brain, and I recommend doing this for anyone listening or for you back in the studio, Jamie. But 2002 included one of the sickest goals I've ever seen. I think it's Joe Sakic or Paul Kariya's goal. But it's Mario Lemieux lets the pass go through his
dummy.
Legs.
Yeah, it's Paul Kariya. Right. It's Paul Kariya.
It's Paul Kariya's goal, right. And it's Sakic's pass then. I'm pretty confident Sakic's in on it. Maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe it's Iserman, and I'm just like remembering the 19 and the lefty passing it and Lemieux sort of deciding to skate through. But the thing that I'll always remember about that is 2002 was also the World Cup in South Korea and Japan. Right, that Brazil ends up winning, and Rivaldo does the same thing. He does like the self nutmeg goal to allow Ronaldo to get the actual shot off, and in the final, like in the final. So it's like both Rivaldo and Mario Lemieux with the same like I'm not taking this, but I'm going to look like I took it through the legs play to sort of make for this unbelievable goal. Both of those goals are just absolutely seared into my memory. They both happened the same year. They both happened in the final. And they were both just like absolute marvels of sort of the most skilled guys being so aware that like they could exercise gravity by not touching the puck. Brilliant stuff. The sort of twin nature of those goals is absolutely seared into my brain from when I was in like grade 9 and just, you know, a giant sports nerd.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible moment. It is Paul Kariya. I'm trying to see who had the pass. I think it was a defenseman, but I'm just trying to pick out who exactly it was. I'll do some research over the break, and then we'll see if we can confirm who exactly that was on the other side, this 23-year-old goal. But yeah, what a moment for Mario Lemieux and for Paul Kariya to get the goal, and just that whole tournament, man, was awesome.
It's Pronger, 44. There you go. It's Chris Pronger.
Yeah, Chris Pronger said, and Mario Lemieux letting it go through his legs for Paul Kariya. Okay, we'll take...
So sick.
Pretty good. Pretty good. We'll take a break here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send in your thoughts, your questions about the Canucks, questions about Team Canada and this tournament. You have a piece looking at depth center options on the trade market, so maybe we can get into that as well. Drancer, final segment next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Final segment of the show here, open segment, so get those texts in, and we can talk depth center options on the trade market for the Canucks in a second here, but going into the inbox a little bit, Austin and Langley text this one in. Are people sleeping on Team Sweden at this tournament? And I know you were saying earlier in the show you think they might have the best blue line at the tournament, but overall, do you think people are doing them a little bit of a disservice, not you know, having Canada and the U.S. as basically co-favorites at this event?
Yeah, I mean, I think Canada and the U.S. should be the favorites. I think it makes sense for Sweden to be a step back, just given, like, their top two centermen are Zibanejad and Pettersson.
Yeah.
Neither of whom has had a good season.
No.
You know, like Zibanejad's 31 going on 37 in terms of his two-way game. And Pettersson is, we've seen it in fits and starts, but have you seen, by the way, that there's this, I wish I could credit it appropriately, but there's a Canucks fan on Blue Sky who's been theorizing that Rick Tocchet, having stated, right, that he wants to see Pettersson have fun and get his confidence back up,
yes,
has helped make sure that Canada's starting Jordan Binnington, right, a goaltender that the Canucks have historically lit up in game one. So a little bit of a conspiracy
12
theory there.
12D chess from Rick Tocchet. I love it.
Well, that is truly 12-dimensional chess. So anyway, obviously I'm not buying it, but I love it. Like, there's something that brought me a lot of joy about
what
that
would be more fun for him than starting
theory.
Than going up against Jordan Binnington. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Pettersson hat trick against Canada. Rick Tocchet, like, oh no.
How could this happen to me?
Yeah. Sorry about that goaltending call, guys. So anyway, no, but I mean, I think Sweden's lack of juice down the middle of their forward group, just given sort of the recent form. I mean, even Joel Eriksson Ek has dealt with injuries this season. You know, it's not like they have a Backstrom caliber guy in this tournament like they would have in Sochi if he hadn't, you know, had the negative test on the day of the gold medal game. Something I don't think the league was too happy about. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting dynamic there. Their blue line is incredible. Incredible, incredible, incredible. And they've got obviously a ton of talent on the wings. They always have a great power play. So Sweden will be dangerous, but I do think it makes sense for them to be sort of a material long shot relative to the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah, because you even look down the roster, right? And, you know, like Elias Lindholm, a valuable player, but also a guy who's been on offensive decline for a lot of years now in the NHL, and not someone who would be in the mix, I don't think, for a spot on Team Canada or Team USA. You know, Gustav Nyquist, you kind of throw in that category as well. And again, they're quality NHL players, don't get me wrong, and depending on how they roll out their lines and how many minutes those guys are playing, it might not matter. They have the high-end talent, but it's that depth edge that Canada and now the U.S. really as well have over the other teams in this field. And somebody else texted in, Tyler, who will win the Rat Bowl? Bennett and Marchand on Team Canada or the Tkachuks on Team USA? Well, Sam Bennett might not be in the lineup. We'll see if that changes against Team USA. But I don't know if any duo is out agitating the Tkachuk brothers united, playing for the United States at this event. That's a pretty formidable rat duo for Team USA.
Oh my God, is it ever? I mean,
although not skating on the same line together, at least not yet.
Yeah, that, which, by the way, give us what we want.
Come on.
Give us what we want. We want, like, I want to be able to talk about a line that's not skating together, but, like, infesting together. You know what I mean? Like, the infestation line, right? Give me the plague line? Yeah, give me Tkachuk Miller.
Oh, man. Can you imagine?
Give me Tkachuk Miller. Let's go.
That would be. Like, they should do that. That would be awesome.
Well, especially because of the way Tkachuk plays, where, like, his best attribute is playmaking down low beneath the hash marks,
yep,
which is a pretty neat compliment, I think, for how Miller plays, right? Where, you know, he plays in straight lines. He makes fun of himself for never having deked once in his NHL career, right? Like, there's a stylistic compliment between them that makes a lot of sense in my mind.
Yeah.
And then obviously you've got Brady setting up shop in the blue paint and, sure, flubbing a few chances, but also finishing a few.
Yeah, finishing quite a few as well. And, you know, that point about, like, hey, look, just give us what we want at a certain point here. We were talking about big questions around Team Canada going into their first game tomorrow. And one thing I want to see, one thing I think we all want to see, is McDavid and MacKinnon on the same line together. They're going to be on the power play together, of course, and MacKinnon and Crosby looks like they'll start together as a forward line as well. But I am curious, you know, I want to see it for the entertainment factor, of course, and just to see what that combination of speed looks like. I'm also curious, I mean, how much and how quickly does John Cooper go to that option? You know, not totally dissimilar to the Edmonton Oilers situation where they start with McDavid and Dreisaitl split up a lot, but they are not shy whatsoever. Knobloch isn't there to put those guys together when it demands. Now, obviously, Team Canada, a lot more options than the Oilers have even. A lot of different combinations you can go to, but I'm really, really curious to see, when does Cooper do that? You know, how, like, what's the threshold he needs to hit? Do we see it every game? Is it break glass in case of emergencies? But man, I want to see that at some point. And it could be like the X factor for Team Canada, how much they're willing to put those guys together.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, did you see today that MacKinnon and Crosby flopped playing center?
Yes, MacKinnon moved back into the middle and Crosby went out to the wing.
I don't think it matters.
No. And this is like, this is every Team Canada, right? Where it's like, we have 9 centers on the team. So it's like, all right, guys, just, you know, go out there and figure it out. And they're all so smart and they do.
Yeah. What do you think about Sam Bennett being behind Konechny in the lineup? And as an affiliated question, what do you think about Sam Bennett in the event that he can't come to terms down in Florida, either before the deadline or after this season? Because I imagine, you know, the leverage for them having a chance to go to a third straight final makes him an absolute own rental lock, right? They're not trading Sam Bennett at this moment.
No.
But what do you think about him as, like, the most obvious Canucks target imaginable and unrestricted free agent?
So I don't mind at all Konechny going. I'll start with that side of it, with Konechny going into the lineup. I really like Travis Konechny, and I think, like, Sorelli, Hagel, Konechny is an awesome, awesome, super fun fourth line, and I like going with the player who has more offensive upside. If I was looking anywhere for Sam Bennett to maybe sneak into the lineup, like Brad Marchand, if he doesn't play really well. I don't know where you are at on Brad Marchand's game right now. I know he has 20 goals. It's not like he's not producing this year, but just as he gets a little bit older, like, I wonder about that as a possibility for Sam Bennett taking his spot at some point in this tournament.
You need him to counter the Kachuk Miller line.
Yeah, but then you get Bennett in. You get Bennett in, right? So you still have a super annoying guy on the other side.
You might need both of them. You might need both of them to counter.
Might need
line.
To load up the most annoying guys they have to go into that matchup. You make a good point. The Bennett thing as a UFA target. So are you signing him? Like, is he now is the idea you're signing him as your second line center behind Elias Pettersson? And is there enough offensive upside as he goes into the next stage of his career for that to make sense? Like, I really like Sam Bennett. I don't know if the UFA contract is going to make a ton of sense for the Canucks.
So, yeah, I mean, he's not 30 yet, right? He's 28.
Yep. He'll be 29 on July 1st. Like, he turns 29 in June.
Happy birthday to him, man. He's going to get paid. What a great birthday present.
No. He turns 29 in June. When the day arrives, he'll be 29.
So you're signing him through his age 36 season.
Yeah.
Not great, but, you know, he's not like super reliant on his speed or physicality. You know, he's mm-hmm. a smart defensive player. I think he's limited offensively. I've always thought he was limited offensively. You know, being able to spend much of the last few years with Huberto and then Kachuk, two of the, like, great playmaking wingers in this league, I think has helped be sort of draw more out of him offensively than what I think he drives himself, if that makes sense. But I still, I mean, I like the brain there. I like the dog in him, obviously, who doesn't.
Of course,
everyone in the
league
does. And I don't know. I mean, where else are you finding a right-handed centerman that doesn't come at the acquisition cost of at least a first and two other assets?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, realistically, like we you know, you mentioned it, but over at the Athletic today, we profiled some depth center options. That the Canucks could consider, you know, maybe they can't find the top line or second line mm-hmm. center that they're ideally after, but could you bring in a useful depth guy? And the guy that leaps off the page for me is Jake Evans. I asked Eric Engels about it yesterday when he was on the program for a reason, like, pointedly, because, He's 28. He's right-handed. You know, he's mostly been a fourth-line guy through his career, but over the last 2 years has really cemented himself as like a matchup guy, top-nine guy, plays up lineup for Marty St. Louis, plays the toughest matchups on that team, kills penalties, wins draws. And just with his age range, I think that's been such a crucial element for Rutherford and Alvin as they've gone about acquiring players and in particular determining who they're going to pay full freight for, right? You think about the DeBrusk contract and how different that is from every other free agent deal that they've signed. Well, he was like the youngest unrestricted yep. free agent on the market. You can't ignore that, right? Hronek, 25. Marcus Pedersen, 28, right? Evans is like right in that wheelhouse where, you know, do you pay for him early? Do you try to extend him? Is that worth the price given that he checks so many boxes of what this team needs? And given the way that his offensive production has spiked over the past 2 years with, I'd add, a sort of concurrent rise in what he's generating offensively from a underlying perspective. You know, like it's not just bounces in his case. Like he seems to have found a different offensive gear in his mid-20s, which isn't unusual for really smart players necessarily, but it's not super common. You know, would from the like perspective of hockey fit, age fit, the template that this team usually uses in determining who to go for aggressively, I just feel like Jake Evans checks more boxes than just about anyone you'll find on the market. So, you know, maybe Bennett's a year older, so that's the sort of difference there. He'll obviously be far more expensive in terms of his contract value than Jake Evans will be. But, you know, isn't Bennett just an amped up version of that, who, if he shakes loose and no one wants to leave Florida right now, given the quality of those facilities, how good the team is, how nice it is to live there. So, you know, that's one that could go right down to the wire, Sam Reinhart style, and get, oh, Sam Bennett shoots left, not right. Excuse me. But nonetheless, stylistically, the fit still makes sense, even if he's not a righty. Excuse me there for having that wrong. The point being, if he shakes loose, is that the sort of deal is that the sort of target that the Canucks would, you know, immediately have jumped to the top of their list?
I just think
I would expect so. Yes.
On Sam Bennett or Jake Evans?
So? Yeah.
Well,
both. I mean, both of them.
I just think with Sam Bennett, the amount you're going to pay, and don't we look at this as not just they need a good forward, but they need someone who can help their offense significantly. And as you said, like Sam Bennett is limited offensively. And so I don't know that you can commit that much money to a guy who feels like a bit of a luxury on this team. Like, I don't know that they need that player in the same way that they need a really dynamic offensive player. Now, you might not be able to get that on the UFA market, right? Like, there's like a handful of dudes like that. You know, Mikko Rantanen, if he makes it, Mitch Marner, Nick Ehlers, there's going to be so much bidding for those players. So it might not be something you can solve in free agency. The other thing that occurs to me as well with Sam Bennett, and you say like, okay, his age risk, it's not as if he relies on speed. I can't help look at the acquisitions of Philip Hedl and O'Connor and how much faster it's made the team look, and wonder if that's going to be something they really pursue going into next season, right? Trying to remake this team as a much faster team. And Bennett doesn't really fit that. Evans, as the more cost-effective kind of, okay, third-line guy, maybe with a little bit of offensive upside, like that makes a lot more sense than trying to hit a big home run on Sam Bennett.
Yeah, I can see that. But on the other hand, you know, the advantage of UFA is there's no acquisition cost versus, yep. you know, Sam. I mean, Jake Evans, I think would be. Yeah, I mean, I think Jake Evans would be one of the most highly sought after players on the trade market.
On the trade market.
Now and the trade deadline. Yeah. So, you know, that's likely to prove exorbitant. You know, I would think a late first at least is sort of what you're looking at.
So who's going to make more money as a UFA this year, Sam Bennett or Nick Ehlers?
Oh, man. I think Nick Ehlers.
Okay.
But I think it'll be
pretty close, right?
Yeah, I mean, Nick Ehlers is a superstar player, man. He hasn't had superstar usage, but in my mind anyway, I think he needs to be viewed that way, just given what he can produce. And by the way, I think there's a lot of people around the league that will view him that way,
mm-hmm.
right? He's incredible. This season, for example, right, if you limit sort of among forwards who've played at least 500 minutes, there just aren't a lot of guys who've been more efficient in terms of generating goals,
yep.
right? Like he's a top 20 guy and large sample, you know, you sort of go back. I mean, it's been like that year after year after year. This is a legit top of the lineup winger whose offensive stats have maybe been held back a bit by the fact that he hasn't always been a PP1 guy in Winnipeg. I think if you can feature him, you know, yeah, I would expect Ehlers, but I don't know if it's going to be by that much given Bennett's championship
and
pedigree.
Playing center and all that, right?
And the edge that he plays with,
and,
too.
And
right?
So that, like the way I'm looking at it is if we're talking it's in the ballpark, like it's close between those two guys, it's Nick Ehlers all day for me, for the Canucks specifically. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
I agree.
And so now you can't guarantee that you're going to win the Nick Ehlers bidding, right? There's going to be a lot of other teams. That's always the thing with UFA. You can look at a UFA and say, wow, what a perfect fit that would be. Let's go all in on it. But you have no idea if you're actually going to land the player. And maybe you do have to pivot to an option that's not quite as good of a fit, but still brings you some value. But I just look at it, and if you have the choice between a guy with that sort of offensive upside, the speed profile, all of it, yeah, he's a winger. Yeah, you still need that center probably, but it's an easy decision at the end of the day if you're trying to decide on kind of one high-profile forward UFA to kind of stake your chances on. I'm going with Nick Ehlers over Sam Bennett.
Yeah, all day. I mean, I think Nick Ehlers is a star, right? Like, I think Nick Ehlers is a star, and I think Sam Bennett's a very, very, very good player. And there is a distinction there, and an important one. And I think what you're bringing up in terms of the offensive push, I think that's something that we touched on in this latest article over at The Athletic. You know, Canucks trade deadline targets, why these 10 depth centers could fit in Vancouver. You know, there's a lot of good players, but I do think you have to be careful. You know, as much as bringing in a depth center helps you by also bumping Pugh Suter, who's really played a matchup role for this team of late, over to the wing, where I think that fattens your forward group in a really useful way. And I think helps, you know, whether it's Hedl or Pettersson that he goes to play with, you know, I think that makes that line far more robust defensively. I think Pugh Suter is a totally capable middle six center, but I think he can be like a special defensive winger. And we've seen it over the past past season and a half in Vancouver, like especially when he's played with Miller and Besser, and the gap between how they control play with Suter and how they control play without him is, you know, pretty significant. So I like the idea of trying to get Pugh Suter over the wings.
Mm-hmm.
I do think you have to be careful if you're the Canucks. You know, a guy like a Radek Foxa or an Oscar Sundqvist, right? Or one of those types of centermen, like even Nick Bjugstad, although to a lesser extent, you know,
Kevin Stenlund in there as well.
Yeah. I think if you end up with like Faxa and Teddy Bluger as your bottom six forward group, like, do you have enough supporting offense? Do you have enough push, especially given that we're not certain that Pettersson's going to be like an elite offensive driver at this point, right? Like, I hope he is, but we don't know that given what we've seen from him so far this season. So, you know, does that leave you as sort of a too limited group offensively? I would argue that it very probably does. Like, that would be my concern anyway in sort of building out your forward group that way. Like, I do think any third line center needs to have a little more of that Pugh Suter type profile where you can at least count on them to be 28 to 35 point guys without a lick of power play time. Like, you need that type of offensive threat if you're sort of building out your bottom six, given Vancouver's issues generating offense at the top of the lineup.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder, I mean, if they can't find a more impact guy up the lineup and somebody under term or with term beyond this year, or at least that they think they can sign beyond this year, I mean, what's your appetite even for spending assets on like a third line center with not a lot of offensive upside, especially if they're a rental this year, right? Yeah, like, yes, it's a need, and then you get Pugh Suter up into your lineup and all that, but I don't think it dramatically changes how we would look at this team going into the playoffs. And you kind of got to ask yourself, like, would we rather just stick with Pugh Suter and Teddy Bluger in our bottom six and Filip Hedl in the top six? Like, I like some of the options, and hey, Jake Evans, if you think he can be a long-term fit as your third line guy and you think you can get him done, okay. But as you said, the cost is going to be sky high for him at the deadline. There's other players on the list I like, but I don't know how much sense it makes for this team to be giving up assets to get a bottom six type center who doesn't really move the needle offensively.
Yeah, I think the exception would be a guy like Christian Dvorak. In the event that Christian Dvorak's $4.55 million contract proves prohibitive for other contenders,
right?
Then that, you know, that sort of might bring the cost down. Maybe he's like this year's Jason Zucker, where you're able to get him at a somewhat depressed acquisition cost because you're taking on the full freight of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of opportunity that I do think will exist for the Canucks here, given the way that they've managed the cap, right? How much cap flexibility they're going to have going into the deadline. You know, 4.55, something they can eat easily, like no problem. And so in a world where you were able to get a player like that for, you know, a C-grade prospect, and maybe you trade your second-round pick, but you get, like, a fifth back,
so yeah.
It's like a trade down instead of an all-out trade, a way of a draft pick. You know, is that something you'd consider, given his familiarity with Rick Tocchet, his sort of penalty-killing panache, the face-off winning? You know, that to me would be sort of the way to, like, split the baby, or the sort of rental player that I could see the Canucks being able to justify, especially if they think they got a shot to retain him.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think to me it's either like long-term impact fit if it becomes available before the deadline, and it's not even
or
so
a
much
bargain buy,
or the creative real bargain buy like that, right?
Yeah.
But the in-between option is like, I don't think this is the year to be looking at those options necessarily. That does it for us today. Thanks for the texts in. Well, we'll be back on the show tomorrow. It's a crossover Wednesday. We'll have Jason Bukla on to really tee things up for the beginning of the Four Nations, Canada versus Sweden, Elias Pettersson versus Rick Tocchet on the ice in Montreal tomorrow. We'll have full coverage of it tomorrow here on. Go ahead.
Jamie, Four Nations facing off.
Four Nations facing off. I've heard that one or two times. Yeah. And they will face off tomorrow. We'll be back tomorrow here on Sportsnet 650.